You are listening to the UFO Talker Podcast. Come with us as we explore UFOs from the past and the present. With insightful discussions, interviews, and reviews, we will add our voice to the mysteries that have been seen in our skies and oceans for all of human history. Now, here's our host, Michael Ryan.
Welcome, everybody, to the podcast. This is Season 2, Episode 30 from Studio 7H here in Ontario, Canada.
And I'm Christine Scott, coming to you live from Studio 9B in the beautiful Warehouse District in Regina, Saskatchewan.
Yes, Christine is with us again.
I'm in the house. Woo!
All is right with the world.
And it's beautiful and sunny in Saskatchewan, and everything is melted.
Yes, and it's a sunny day here in southern Ontario. A little bit cold, but sunny nonetheless. So, Christine, the first thing we want to get to is this is going to be another kind of unusual episode where we are taking it from the pages of official RCMP documents.
Yes, and it's a little known Saskatchewan.
That's right. That's right. We've stumbled across another one. And we're going to call this the Prochner Farm incident is what we are going to refer to it as, but we'll get to that a little bit later. It's very good. But I want to bring up a few bits of news first. We'll get some stuff out of the way. I want to bring up my blog is now up and running for the Robert Hastings interview. So I'm going to put a link, like I did last week, in the show notes, and that'll take you right to the blog where you can read it. It's very interesting. Robert Hastings, of course, he wrote UFOs and Nukes, very unbelievable ufologist. And he mentioned some things I've never heard of before in the interview, so it's definitely worth a read. It's about a 10-minute read. And then also, on last week's show, I mentioned the UFO conference at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, which is going to be held from September 20th to the 22nd. On their website, they had a to-be-announced guest. They had lots of other guests, but I've since learned that it will be Travis Walton is now added to the list of all the other speakers. And there is another big event coming in May, and that is Contact in the Desert. And that is what Forbes magazine calls the Woodstock of ufology.
That's a great
that's title. A great title. And that's going to be held from May 30th to June 3rd. And they weren't kidding. It's got a lot of names. I'm not going to read all the names because there's about 40 or 50 speakers. But kind of the top names are going to be George Norrie, George Knapp, Dr. A.V. Loeb, Richard Doland, Nick Pope, because Nick Pope is everywhere.
He's everywhere.
He is everywhere. And Whitley Strieber, Travis Walton, Robert Salas, Paul Hynek, who we've interviewed on this show, Ben Henson, who we like, and actress Dee Wallace, who is in the film E.T., and I believe she's there for spiritual healing is kind of what she's into now. But that was just some of the names. There's literally 30 or 40 more names. It's they're right. It's the Woodstock.
It's the Avengers of UFO.
Yes. Yeah. It's the get the party started. Everybody is there for sure. And then you have some news.
On this show and all shows, we talk about the government talking about UFOs. Well, on March 1st, there was an item on CTV News, the headline, Document Reveals First Known Canadian UFO Study in Nearly 30 Years Now Underway. I missed the item in the news, but Grant Cameron referenced it on his Facebook page. The Canadian government's top scientist has launched a study into unidentified aerial phenomena, and it's called the Sky Canada Project. It's a study being conducted by the Office of the Chief Science Advisor of Canada. For non-Canadian listeners, that's the person who briefs the Prime Minister. It's the Prime Minister's Science Advisor. The first known official Canadian UFO research effort nearly 30 years.
Wow.
CTV News obtained a PowerPoint presentation. The study seeks to understand how UAP reports are handled in Canada and to offer recommendations for improvement if needed. The project plans to collect information this winter and spring before preparing an internal draft report in the fall. A final public report in the winter or spring of 2024. Who is compiling and analyzing UAP observations made by Canadians? The first page of the slide deck asks.
Yes.
Public records and declassified documents show the answer may involve federal transportation officials, the Canadian Air Force, and more. So it's, according to this, the presentation circulating within federal organizations, approach for input, Transport Canada, Canadian Space Agency, and who are we going to talk about today? The Royal Canadian Mounted Police.
Yes, yes.
Yep.
And, that should be, I'm kind of looking forward to that.
Yeah.
I think somewhere I've read before that they make a big point of saying, now we're not investigating any of these, mm-hmm. we're just kind of passing stuff along. Mm-hmm. That's kind of their yeah. mantra. But it'll still be interesting to see what they've done with all of our taxpaying dollars.
Yeah, and it lists preparing for collaboration with U.S. officials too, the Pentagon, NASA. And there's an interesting page four of the presentation. This is interesting. Motivations include supporting science to document rare natural phenomena, encourage transparency and information access to prevent conspiracy theories, and aiding national security to prevent undetected intrusions.
Hmm.
So, yeah, I saw a later article that said, well, it may be out in the fall. It may be out slightly later. This first report says spring. Well, we're getting close to the spring, so we'll see. But it's supposed to be released to the public sometime this year.
If it's done by the same people who do the access to information requests, it could be longer mm-hmm. because
that's what I thought.
We have one that we're waiting to hear back on. It's almost, mm-hmm. I think we're at the 6 month.
Mm-hmm.
6 months to get back on this. And, you know, when you put in these access to information requests, they're the mm-hmm. same as the FOIA, Freedom of Information Act requests in the States. They just have a different name in Canada. And I think, you know, we're waiting 6 months just to hear that, oh, we found nothing, which happens a lot of the time.
And I did find the second reference now saying, it will be released by early fall, according to a CTV News item by, we know his name, Daniel Otis.
That's right. We've interviewed him on the show.
Yeah. Mona Niemer is the name of the science advisor. And Niemer has been briefing Parliament Science and Research Committee. So spring, early fall, who knows?
That's right.
Yeah.
Something else I want to mention is as our listeners can probably gather, bits and pieces of the show are recorded obviously before the date they're released, and that's what we're doing today, is recorded several days before the release. So as of right now, I'm not really sure if we're going to have a audio excerpt from a book today. So there may be one, there may be not one. So unfortunately, I can't mention that. We don't know yet. So it'll be a surprise mm-hmm. if it happens today. So Christine, we have on today's shout out is we have picked the town of Swan River, Manitoba.
Yes.
Which has a population of 4,014 people. And, you know, as our listeners know, I've looked at a lot of small towns recently on the internet to always prepare for this segment. There is something about Swan River. It's not like it has the best main street or anything like that, but definitely there's something there that makes it kind of interesting. I was really kind of fascinated by everything that that I have found. And one of the things is it had a movie theater.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, with a population that small, you don't really normally see movie theaters there. And not only do they have a movie theater, it was only started in the early 2000s, 2001, I believe. So it was somebody's dream, because a lot of these movie theaters, you know, they're from 1930, and then people keep buying them. But it was his somebody's dream to open it. So, and it looks very unique. It'd be nice to have, if you lived in a small town like that, to have a movie theater and something in an area like that.
Yep. If you haven't been to Saskatchewan or Manitoba, we have a lot of these really gorgeous communities that aren't very big, but they're very picturesque and they're surrounded. We have way more lakes in Saskatchewan and Manitoba than a lot of people realize. You know, a lot of people, you know, you think of Ontario for lake country. Swan River is a beautiful area, and they think it was named for trumpeter swans that bred in the area. But on a personal note, that's where my people came to Canada and settled. My dad's family was from the Ukraine and settled in the area. So if there are any Horechkas in the area, you are probably related to me.
Right on. And the thing is, from where Christine lives, it's only a short 3-hour and 52-minute drive.
I believe I was there once as a very small child, meeting my grandparents, who lived on a farm in the area and did not speak English. So they vexed me considerably. I do remember not understanding my grandparents.
So now, Christine, you have to tell us, well, wait a minute. Christine's last name is Scott. Why isn't this matching up with?
Well, because when I was born in Yorkton, that where my parents met, and my dad's last name at the time was still Horechka. And he thought that, you know, me growing up, this was the rationale given to me. It might be a difficult name. So we changed our name to Scott, which does not match my nationality at all. I am so Ukrainian on both sides. Ukrainian and a little bit of gypsy on my mother's side. And so a lot of people, you know, I get these questions, are you related to Mike Scott, Leanne Scott? And I have to say no. And so I didn't pick it as a stage name. It was a decision from my dad. Yes. So I went from Christine Marie Horechka to plain old Chris Scott.
Wow.
Yeah.
But a lot of people did that years ago when they had, when they came to Canada and they just had names that were a lot harder to pronounce, things like that, they would change them. It was kind of a thing, I believe.
Yeah. And I believe Horechka means buckwheat.
Maybe that's why he changed it.
Yeah, I guess so, because, yeah. But, yeah, that's as far as I know what it means. So, but, yeah, you're right, it was a common thing. And also on my mom's side, when people came through Ellis Island, her family name, Skilnick, has dozens of different spellings. Hmm.
Something else I noticed about Swan River, Manitoba, is they have a giant swan. In the city.
Yes.
I think it's in front of the museum there. I have watched a few videos, as I always do. One thing I have to make note of Swan River, for having such a small population, just over a little bit over 4,000, they have a lot of buildings. Like, I don't think I've ever seen a community that's this small with this many buildings. Like, it has kind of a traditional main street, you know, with about 15 or so shops on either side, so that's kind of normal. But as you drive out of town on either side, just the buildings go on and on, and I think, well, who's working at all these places? Like, the whole town works. There's got to be zero unemployment in Swan River, because I think I counted probably about 80 different buildings, and I thought, where's everyone coming from? There's only 4,000 people that live here.
Well, and it also has a rodeo. It has a rodeo at the Northwest Roundup at the end of July. So I'm thinking that would probably bring a lot of people to the area. So now I'm curious how many hotels are around there.
Well, I know that they have a few of them, because I watched some of the videos. And they do have a McDonald's, an A&W, and a KFC, for sure. They also have... And I just saw this by coincidence. is they have a person named Brett Medill, who is from Swan River, who works in Hollywood. And he is a visual effects technician, and his last film that he worked on was the Tom Hanks film A Man Called Otto.
Cool.
So there you go. For such a small town, they have somebody who's fairly famous. And of course, Christine, we cannot do a shout out without mentioning a bakery and a restaurant.
Yeah.
and you have found a bakery that I wholly concur with.
Devon's Cookies. It's a specialty cooking baking business run by a young fella named Devon Jelinek, who is legally blind. Devon's Cookies are massively successful. He has done very well for himself. And I mean, who does not love a good cookie bakery?
Exactly. And so, yeah. Like, the next time we're in Swan River, we're going to Devon's Cookies.
Yeah.
And then also,
I did look up the varieties. Yes. Ooh, yeah.
And then also, restaurant-wise, and I hope I'm pronouncing this right, it's the Madoco restaurant. That is M-A-D-O-C-O, so I hope I pronounced that correctly. And that looks very good. They actually have a lot of, believe it or not, in a town this size, there's a lot of restaurants there that look very good, but this one looked especially good. So that's our shout-out today for Swan River, Manitoba. They're just something unique about it. I don't know. It's particularly grabbed me, but of course, I would only go there in the summer, but that's just me.
Yes, I have spoken frequently about prairie winters.
Yes, yes.
And Manitoba gets the polar vortex even worse than we do. I think one year Winnipeg had it for 72 straight days.
Oh, boy.
And we'll be right back after this message.
In the early morning hours of October 3rd, 1976, Sergeant St. Pierre of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police was sitting at the operations desk in Richibucto, New Brunswick. The ringing of the phone broke the silence of the office. Sergeant St. Pierre looked at his watch. It was 3:30 a.m. On the line was a very excited Joseph Robichaud. He told Sergeant St. Pierre something very unusual had happened to him, and if he could meet him 5 miles up Highway 11 on Highway 480. When Sergeant St. Pierre's police car rolled up on Joseph Robichaud, his face was pale and he was quite frightened. Joseph took a breath. At 2:55 that morning, he had been driving west on Highway 480. He noticed a large, red glowing object about the size of the moon. He pulled his car to the side of the road and turned off his car. As soon as he turned his car engine off, the object started to move slowly up and down. Then the object started moving towards him. Fearful for his life, he turned the car on and accelerated in the opposite direction. He soon reached speeds of 115 miles per hour. In his rearview mirror, he could see the red glowing object catching up to his car. Within seconds, the UFO was 20 feet above the top of his car. Its red glow had lit up the inside of his car and the road all around him. As he approached a small group of homes by the side of the road, he slammed on his brakes and ran to the front door of one of the houses. He looked over his shoulder and the red glowing UFO was hovering silently above his car. Suddenly, the UFO turned on its side and the red glow became more intense. It was the size of a house. As Joseph dropped to his knees in fear, the UFO took off straight up at tremendous speed. Sergeant St. Pierre said that Joseph Robichaud could not have faked that kind of fear. Joseph Robichaud would never forget that night. He was never given an explanation of what it could have been or where it had come from.
So, Christine, on today's episode, we have plucked another fascinating case from the files of the RCMP, and we have called this the Prochner Farm Incident. And I think Christine and I, we've talked about this off air, is there is a lot of cases in these RCMP files that are just not known, or I have never known of them before. Just to give you an example, there's a famous case in Saskatchewan where the farmer Edwin Furr, and this was about 1974, he saw three UFOs, I believe, in his farm field. Now, that story, it made big news. Like, you can go on the internet and you can see many newspapers covering it. It's in a lot of UFO books. And it is definitely an interesting case, so I'm not saying that. But the case we're going to talk about today, I think, is far more important and interesting, and there is not a word of it anywhere that I know of. And it's just fascinating to find these things, like they've been hidden all of these years. So there is something to be said for research.
Yes.
It does.
And the Edwin Furr case, the town of Langenberg, his farm is close to Langenberg. It's on their town bio.
Yes.
It's still a pretty big thing for them.
Yeah. And that was 1974. And I believe Edwin Furr, I believe he's still with us.
I think so too, yeah.
And also, I think the RCMP officer that investigated it, I think he's still with us. Mm-hmm. But he also has, that officer is on YouTube and has a video that he did several years ago.
Before we go into this, as a Saskatchewanian, let me set up the area for you guys. One thing you need to know about Saskatchewan, it's a very large province with a comparatively small population. It's really spread out over the province, and the RCMP are the primary rural police in Saskatchewan. A lot of communities don't have a big enough population or tax base to support a local police force. So the RCMP is responsible for policing in a large part of Saskatchewan. And, you know, that's why when we'll be talking about Saskatchewan UFO cases, it'll be a lot of RCMP reports rather than, you know, civic police forces. And the area we're going to talk about is around the Qu'Appelle Valley, which is a beautiful area. If you want to compare it to, it's basically Saskatchewan's cottage country. It's gorgeous area. It's a valley. There's the Qu'Appelle River in the area, Echo Lake. It's a gorge. I can't tell you if you drive through Saskatchewan how beautiful this area is. But interestingly enough, when I was writing for the Prairie Dog, I wrote an article or basically a list about famous Saskatchewan UFO sightings. And I haven't been able to find more reference to this. But according to the Jim and Cora Lorenzen book, UFOs Over the Americas, there's a Transport Canada letter from the late 50s stating they think the Qu'Appelle Valley is the site of a UFO base.
Wow.
A UFO landing site.
Wow.
So I haven't been able to find more reference, but obviously I found enough at the time for that item. So let's keep that in mind when we're talking about this area. The towns that you'll hear mentioned, the farm is just outside of Qu'Appelle, which is a pretty small community. It's about a population of 668. It's 50 kilometers east of Regina, around Highway 35. The RCMP detachment referred to, and again, the detachment will be Indian Head, which is a community about 69 kilometers east of Regina on Trans-Canada. When we say RCMP detachment, it's a subdivision. It would be a subdivision of the Regina RCMP. And one thing you need to know about Regina, we're the home of the RCMP. They train here. Obviously, it's, you know, RCMP base of operations major in Saskatchewan, but this is where the RCMP come from. They train here at Depot.
And do they have the, I should know this being a Canadian, but is that where the musical ride is?
Yep. Yeah, we have the musical ride. Keep in mind when we're talking about the Indian Head, RCMP detachment, and the town of Qu'Appelle, these places are fairly close together in terms of Saskatchewan.
So just for our listeners who are not familiar with that, the musical ride is a lot of RCMP officers in their, you know, red uniforms, which are they're more for show now, but they're on horses, and it's quite spectacular to see. It's a lot of, you know, it's almost like cavalry. It's kind of spectacular to see this many men on horses and in their uniforms. And they call
I was going to say, it's called the musical ride. I think it's the equivalent of, if you see in Britain, trooping the colors, people in uniforms on horseback. It's a big tourist attraction, big thing here in the summer. And I'm embarrassed to say I've never personally seen it, even though I live here. But it is, I know all about it because it is a big thing for Regina. And for RCMP and Canadians in general.
And also, just to go over something for our listeners that are not from Canada, which a lot of the listeners are not from Canada. And so the RCMP, that stands for the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. And it would be the equivalent of the FBI in the United States, because it's a federal organization. They're the federal police. It's everything the FBI is. But it has this extra dimension where in a lot of provinces, they are also the police force. So there's RCMP police cars, and they would police your town and that kind of thing. Mm. Yeah, but it has the same, the RCMP has the same effect as the FBI. So if the RCMP is knocking at your door, not a good thing.
That's the fence. You don't want that. You have done something.
Not a good thing. No. And of course, they have their motto, you know, we always get our man, which is fairly accurate. Yep. The other thing I wanted to mention is, and this is kind of when people always ask, what's the main difference from the United States from Canada? And people from the United States who've been to Canada and Canadians that have traveled in the United States, it pretty much looks the same. I mean, stores, roads, cars, it all looks the same. But one kind of cultural difference is in the United States, the settlers went out west, and so it was the settlers came first and the law came second. In Canada, it was always the law came first and the settlers followed. So that's a big difference. And there's lots of, if people are interested in this, there are lots of stories of RCMP going into areas to put the law to the land first before the settlers came. Lots of amazing stories if you like to read that.
And there is an RCMP museum here in Regina, and Charles Dickens' son was in the RCMP.
Wow.
And it was either here or Manitoba, I can't remember. But there's a book out called Corporal Dickens of the Mounted.
And something you mentioned Indian Head, the Indian Head Detachment. Mm-hmm. So here's a little Michael Ryan trivia I can throw in here. So back in the early 2000s, I wrote for a magazine called Super 8 Today for about 5 years, and I did a lot of feature writing for them. And I did an article on a place called Film Rescue International, which is in Indian Head, Saskatchewan. Yeah. And what is great about Film Rescue International is at the time, and this was, you know, the early 2000s, they were one of only two companies in the world that specialized in rescuing old film. So if you find an old cartridge from 60 years ago or 80 years ago in your grandfather's or great-grandfather's attic, normally those are no good. Like you can't take this anywhere and have it developed, especially now. But they specialize in rescuing these old cartridges of film, and they get images from them and all that. And they also do this for old movie film that hasn't been developed. And they've built quite a reputation over the years. The FBI and the Smithsonian and the RCMP, on and on, come to them first when they have discovered old film that hasn't been developed. So there's a bit of trivia for you in that. Mm-hmm. And it's in a very nice-looking building, a fully restored building in Indian Head. So, Christine, we're going to start this report off, and I want to mention again, this is from an official RCMP document. I mean, it's typed up by Constable F.W. Pushka. So this case, it happened on August 4th, 1968. And also, I want to mention for our listeners, so one thing, I grew up in Huntington Beach, California, and also in Canada, we watch a lot of U.S. TV. So I'm guilty of making the mistake of calling our constables police officers. I've done it on many of the shows that we've done this season and last season. I may probably even do it again during this during this segment, but pretty much all over Canada, policemen and women are referred to as constables. That's their real legal title, not police officers. Although I think in some places they are called police officers in Canada, but forgive me, I make this mistake all the time. But it was Constable F.W. Pushka who took this information from the Proctors. So on the morning of August 4th, 1968, Kenneth Proctor, and this was seen by three people. So Kenneth was the son, William Proctor was the dad, and Julius Proctor was the mother of William. And so Kenneth, he was coming home at approximately 4:15 a.m. Now, one thing we should note is these are all farmers, so that's probably why they're up so early. Now, in the report, it didn't say where Kenneth was coming from, because he was coming to the house at 4:15 a.m. So we're not sure where he was coming from at that early hour, but he was coming home at 4 a.m., He pulled into the driveway, and he noticed an illuminated object hovering above the house. And so this was only, you know, about 30 feet, 40 feet above the house, so you can't miss it. And the constables always mention in the reports if the people had been drinking. So they always say, no, they weren't drinking, anything like that. And the object that Kenneth saw was circular, and it seemed to be spinning, and it was lit up, but the light wasn't lighting up the ground or the house or anything like that. It was just mainly the object was lit up. And as we'll find out later, it was between 20 and 30 feet wide. And as it was hovering over the house, of course, he was a little bit frightened. He was in his car, so he stopped. Now, it said he immediately got out of his car and ran to the house, because, of course, it's pretty shocking, as you can imagine. You know, and it's not that high in the sky. That's another thing that'd be a bit terrifying. And so the door was locked of his house. So he ran back to his car, and he sat in his car for about 10 minutes. Watching this object. Now keep that in mind, what I just said, this 10 minutes, because that 10 minutes seems to get lost in the rest of the report. So after he had watched it for 10 minutes, which, boy, that would be freaking me out, he ran back to the house, and so he kicked the front door in. So it also doesn't mention that if he got in trouble. I thought, wow, you know, you kick your house, the door in, and I think your dad's going to be a little bit upset with that. But
yes,
no one mentions that in the report. And so he runs upstairs to his dad to tell him to come out. But his dad doesn't believe him, which is odd because this happens a lot in these UFO situations where someone sees something, they run inside to tell someone to come look. And the first thing is they don't believe what their son or daughter or spouse is telling them. And I always think, well, why wouldn't you? Like, you know, it's not really a prank when to come in and go, hey, you should see the UFO outside, and there's nothing there. That's not really a prank, right? So, he didn't want to come out. And then, of course, William comes out, and then he sees it. And then, you know, he's describing the same thing when by the time he got outside, the object had gone over the barn and he noticed it over the barn. And while they were watching it, it would stop spinning and then very rapidly go 50 to 100 feet in any direction and stop and then start spinning again. And then I should also mention it was overcast that night and there was a new moon, but it had rained a little bit earlier and there had been lightning also in the area. So I'm just going to read a little bit from the statement that Kenneth gave in his report. So this is after he had watched the object for a while. He said, and this is a quote from the report. He said, "I backed the car up about 40 feet and sat there for about 10 minutes. After that, I ran back to the house and kicked the door open. I then ran upstairs and woke my father up. He did not believe me, but he got up. I stayed upstairs for a couple minutes, then joined my father outside. By this time, when I saw the object again, it was above the barn, but it was quite a bit lower. The object seemed to move away, then come back. The object did not send out any light rays. There was no noise coming from the object. I watched the object for a few minutes while it was over the barn and then went into the house to bed." Now, this is another thing, and we can talk about this a little bit, is there is a British ufologist. Her name is Jenny Randles. And so she came up with this term, the Oz effect. And a lot of times this happens when people are near or are viewing UFOs. Mm-hmm. They do things that don't make sense. And I can kind of agree with this, because if people who've listening to the show for a long time, they know that I saw a UFO when I was 8 with my mother. And we watched this UFO very close range. It's in it's episode 2 in season 1, if you want to hear the full story. And for the full 15 to 20 seconds that we were watching this object, neither my mom or I spoke to each other. So I can tell you that later when I thought about this, so that is not typical of our relationship. Like, you know, if anything else, I would have been talking to my mom. She would have been talking to me. It's like, look at that, or blah, blah, blah. So that we were silent for those 15 to 20 seconds. I always thought that was odd. And then, so when I had read about the Oz effect years later, it really made me think about these situations, because when people are in close proximity to UFOs, they always seem to do things that are uncharacteristic. And so when Kenneth said, you know, after he had been out there watching it with his dad, he went to bed. So is that a normal thing that you would do? Like, you're watching this thing that is totally, you know, never seen anything like this before or after, and you go to bed? Like, that doesn't make any sense. It seems like one of those Oz effect moments.
Mm-hmm. Carl Jung actually wrote a book about UFOs and the UFO experience. It's fairly obscure. We only get it in the bookstore rarely. But I hope I'm summarizing this correctly. Jung thought UFOs were a literal structure in the brain. And I think that he meant that you processed UFOs the way you would process, you know, religion or phenomena, but Jung actually has a whole theory about this. I don't believe I would have to look into a bit more, but a lot of people don't realize Jung was quite interested in that, what you're just talking
yes.
about.
Yes. Yeah. It is mysterious.
Yeah.
Especially William, after he had come outside, and we should mention that the Prochner farm, it was about a mile and a half south of Qu'Appelle.
Mm-hmm.
And when William had come out, he had viewed the UFO was now over the barn instead of the house where Kenneth had originally seen it. And he was saying that it was about 30 feet above the barn. That's what William was saying. And then also, again, we're just talking about the Oz effect. So after William had watched it for a few minutes, then he went back to bed.
Yep.
it just makes you think. Now, something I would really love to know, people don't think of it now because phones are everywhere, But in the late 60s, even then, it's not everyone who had a phone in their house.
No.
So it's quite possible, because you would think, well, why wouldn't they call the police? Like, mm-hmm. you know, come look at this. It's quite possible they didn't have a phone. So mm-hmm. that's why they... Now, why he went back to bed? My adrenaline would have been at, you know, 100 mm-hmm. plus. So I'm not sure I could have done that. But
well, there was also the delay, according to the reports. There was a delay in Prochnor reporting the sighting. He came to the detachment in person to report yes. the sighting, as it says in the transcripts, reporting a flying saucer, in quotation marks, at 4 a.m. August 4th, 68. It goes on to say, report filed 12 August 68. Due to the nature of this complaint, he failed to report it immediately.
Yeah, because that's, and also the stigma is still around today, but back then, mm-hmm. to report a UFO, people questioned your sanity right away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So they probably thought about it, but obviously this was so dramatic in their lives mm-hmm. that they had to report it. And yeah. it was, you have to keep in mind that if you're a farmer in Saskatchewan in the 60s, pretty much all those farmers were kind of no-nonsense, you know.
Oh, yeah, still are.
Yeah, so, you know, if his neighbors were saying, you saw what? Like,
mm-hmm. yep, what the gosh darn heck are you talking about?
Yeah, so yeah. it's not something that you would have been comfortable. So for him to actually go days later, it must have weighed really heavily on his mind. Something else we should mention is that the officer, F.W. Pushka, he also went to neighboring farms around the Prochnor farm to see if they had seen anything.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a family, the Eberts, and I think mm-hmm. their farm was about a mile away, I guess.
Half mile northeast of the Prochnor farm.
Yes, and I can't remember her first name, but...
Oh, Elizabeth.
Elizabeth.
Elizabeth Eberts, yeah.
So she was up at 4 a.m., and what she heard was kind of a whirring, whining sound. And that caused her to look out the window. Now, she saw no lights or anything like that, but this sound to her was disturbing enough that she wondered where it was coming from. And the F.W. Pushka, he couldn't find anyone else who had noticed anything at that time of the day.
Basically, this situation, this sighting, is not just a multiple witness. It's a multi-generational sighting. So Julius Prochnor was alerted by the two, reported an object hovering over the barn, says it was quite large, 25 to 30 feet across. The bottom of the object was lit up. It was revolving quickly, thinks it was hovering at twice the height of the barn. The light coming from it was dull. You could not see any light cast upon the ground or the barn. This is the first mention of color. Julius reported the light appeared to be a dull orange color, that the object appeared to be round-shaped, but couldn't see what the top looked like. So actually, we're getting a little more detail from Julius here. It hovered over the barn for approximately 1 minute, then it stopped spinning and flew to the southwest of the barn. It flew approximately 50 feet and stopped, and then began to spin around again. And again, Julius goes back in the house. Yeah. Object was still hovering when I went back into the house.
It is odd.
Yeah.
It's definitely odd that they all left the, I don't think I could leave. Like I think you'd be compelled to just keep looking at this thing. Cause she mentions that, you know, specifically she had never seen anything like that before in her life.
Yeah.
And Christine, we have to mention something here. It kind of threw us both off when we were looking at the reports earlier. Is, you know, it's funny, your mindset, because in most of these RCMP reports, it gives the date of birth for all these people. So it gave her birth as, you know, I forget the month, but it was 89.
Yeah.
And so obviously we're thinking 1989. So, oh, she'd still be pretty young. And then we realized, oh, it's 1889. Yeah. like, it shows you how, you know, the time you're in is important to your reference, right?
Yeah.
So she was born in 1889. And so she, her report actually, to be honest, was the most specific of the three of them.
It is. Yeah, it mentions details that the other two don't. The color, we get the color, a shape.
And also, it just, the way she spoke or the way he typed her report seemed to be a lot more organized and thoughtful.
Okay, we're going to talk about the physical evidence. Prior to reporting this incident, and I'm quoting from the files, William Proctor had noticed some unusual marks in his pasture near the barn. And I'm just going to take a little side note here. That area, I mean, there's a lot of farms in Saskatchewan. The report doesn't mention any livestock. So I'm guessing, well, barn, yeah, they would have to have livestock. I would be guessing they would be growing oats, flax. Pulse crops are big in Saskatchewan. Prior to reporting the incident, he noticed some unusual marks in the pasture near the barn. Had not noticed before, connected them with the UFO sighting. Upon patrolling the scene, marks found to be circular in shape. The diameter of these circles varied from 4.5 feet to 5 feet. These circles were noted to be clear of grass, except for the center 2 feet. Four of the marks appeared to be in a square pattern. However, on measuring these, was found no real pattern existed. Proctor said that the UFO had been observed above this point. Because of rain that were slightly obliterated, Proctor was questioned regarding these marks, but was unable to supply an authentic explanation. And when you read ahead near the end of the file, it basically said, well, we didn't think these were important, so we didn't take any pictures of them.
Wow. What were you thinking?
Like, it wasn't relevant. There's something
goodness.
We didn't think it was connected or it was relevant. So there's no, when you read the file, there's no sketches, no photographs. And they basically say, we didn't think it was important enough to take a picture of these.
That's kind of unfortunate.
Yeah. The name of the colonel investigating the marks was Colonel Artie Anderson. And weren't we talking about there aren't any colonels in the RCMP?
Yeah, so that kind of popped out at me because there's no rank in the RCMP that's a colonel, and he doesn't mention it in the report, but obviously that's a Canadian Army official. And, you know, for people who don't know much about the Army, colonel is an upper rank. Like, that is pretty way up the chain. So for a colonel to come out and look at this, that doesn't make sense. You know, you think to yourself, especially in the 60s, they were, you know, the U.S. Air Force and typically the Canadian government as well. They would play down all of these sightings, like, oh, you know, they were seeing swamp gas, or you were seeing Venus. Venus is
or
what,
you were drunk.
Or you were drunk. Or something like that. And I thought, so, wait a minute, this was important enough for the RCMP to bring along a colonel from the Canadian military. So I'm sure they mainly have more important things to do. So it just goes to show what they really thought about these UFO sightings.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would really love to find out more about the Transport Canada letter quoted by the Lorenzans, that area might be a UFO base and landing site.
It's funny because one thing I have to tell the listeners is, as I'm perusing through these files, these RCMP files, one thing that you notice right away is, so publicly, the RCMP, the Canadian military, all of these places, they didn't seem very interested in UFOs. Oh, you know, we send these along to the National Research Council, and then they see if it's a meteor, and then they file it. Yeah, we're not really into that.
Yeah.
But then, on the other side, there's all of these reports, and these are all typewritten. This takes time. If you didn't know how to type, each one of these reports would probably be an hour of your time, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm thinking, there were so many of these reports, you would think if the powers that be in the RCMP felt that this was really nonsense, don't you think they'd be sending out a directive? Yeah, don't do these. It's a waste of time. Mm-hmm. It's really man-made objects. And, you know, we have more important police work to do. But a lot of these reports, they spent a lot of time investigating this. So you think there had to have been word from somewhere that this was a more important thing than what we're reading about.
Mm-hmm.
So, Christine, one thing I noticed that at the bottom of this report, it was signed off by Edward Lissick, and he was in charge of the Regina division of the RCMP there. And it's interesting because, you know, superintendent is fairly high up. And so he was reading this report and signing off on it. And I noticed he did several of these reports, not just this one, but there's several other ones as well. So it was important enough for him to spend his time on it. And something just to make note of Edward Lissick, for him to sign off on all of these, he definitely had an interest in what was going on. And Edward Lissick, he actually rose pretty quickly in the ranks of the RCMP. So he actually became an assistant commissioner. And that was in 1973. And so in the RCMP, the highest is the if you're the commissioner of the RCMP, it's kind of like being the director of the FBI. So it was pretty high up that and he rose pretty quickly. Another interesting thing about Edward Lissick is when he was 87 years old, he lived in a retirement apartment. And one day he was found missing. They did a search for him, and he ended up being found. But they found him, he was dead.
Mm.
And so I thought, you know, oh, he was 87. He wandered away from his retirement village. You know, it's maybe he was confused, things like that. But I was reading his obituary page, you know, where people can leave comments. And normally in the comment sections of obituaries, people say, oh, you know, he was a nice guy and this and that. There was actually three comments where the people said, you know, well, Edward, he didn't have dementia. He wasn't disoriented. He was not assisted in any way. He was quite capable. And they said, what took so long for them to search for him? Because apparently there was a lack of the police actually searching for him in the beginning. But then two people were questioning the part where he just got lost or confused and just died of natural causes. So that's a bit mysterious. I mean, I don't want to make that more mysterious than it is, but it definitely makes you think, you know, when people other people are questioning it who knew him a lot better. But that's just a little side note. So, Christine, I just want to mention that along with the typewritten reports that I found, there was three other telex reports that were included. And they were sent from these telexes, which summarized the report that we just went over. They were sent from the commissioner of the RCMP to Canadian Forces headquarters in Ottawa.
Mm.
And, you know, this also lends to how important these documents were taken because, you know, boy, with all the stuff that was going on, and they worried about their lines of communication being clogged up with things that weren't important, you know, why would they send this unless they felt it was important? So here is this case, which we have called the Prochnor Farm incident. It was important enough to be summarized and sent by a telex from the commissioner of the RCMP to Canadian Forces headquarters in Ottawa.
Mm-hmm.
Just ponder that for a second. So, Christine, what we have uncovered in the last few weeks, so two shows ago was the Bear Point incident, and now the Prochnor Farm incident. just two cases that I believe are just not known, have never been known before from these RCMP documents. Mm-hmm. The RCMP and the Department of National Defense absolutely took UFOs mm-hmm. seriously, at least in the 60s, and then probably to this day. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. I find it hard to believe that in the U.S., Canada, or anywhere, that their militaries are not interested. You would have mm-hmm. to be, because these things are penetrating your airspace all the time. It's your job to be concerned about that. I refuse to believe that no one cared about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think publicly they didn't say anything because they can't stop it. They have no idea what it is. So you don't want to admit that things are entering your airspace at will and mm-hmm. you can do nothing about it, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. And that old nonsense about a revelation causing a panic. I mean, at this point, right?
Yes. I think we're kind of well beyond that.
Yeah.
But Christine, we are going to keep on top of this for sure. Mm-hmm. And we'll keep mm-hmm. looking into this. I can tell our listeners there are other reports that we are probably going to highlight in the coming weeks. It's just amazing what has been hidden all of these years. But as Christine likes to say, we will keep you posted.
Mm-hmm.
Here are the Canadian Civil Aviation Anomalies for the week of March 18th through March 22nd, 2024. This week's anomalies report is setting a record. This is the first week since we have been reporting these that we have 5 UFO reports. On March 18th, 7 UFOs were observed in the Quebec region at 0149 Zulu time. 7 distinct objects were flying from east to west. The objects were bright and red in color. On March 19th, a Jazz Bombardier CL-600-2D24 en route from Vancouver, British Columbia to Yellowknife Northwest Territories reported 3 bright lights which grew dimmer. Then multiple lights appeared and disappeared for the next couple of minutes. No traffic in vicinity. Also on March 19th, an Air Canada Boeing 737 MAX 8 flying from Edmonton, Alberta to Toronto Lester B. Pearson International Airport reported an array of 5 lights above FL-500. Canadian Air Defense was notified. Also on March 19th, a Cargojet Airways Boeing 767-300 flying from Winnipeg, Manitoba to Montreal Mirabel, Quebec reported seeing a strange light coming towards them and then fading. There were 3 to 4 lights. On March 21st, the tower controller observed what appeared to be a drone over the Carrefour Fairview Pointe Claire at high altitude. The possible drone moved along Highway 40, then remained overhead of the village of Pointe Claire for a few minutes. The NAV Canada Auxiliary Radar Display System showed a primary target intermittently. There was no impact on operations, and all flights proceeded to their destinations without further incident. And now, the UFO Talker podcast brings you an audio excerpt from the book Aliens Are With Us, What I Learned from Aliens Visiting Me Over 100 Times Spanning 50 Years, by Bill Roundtree. Used by permission from the author. Read by Joy Ryan. Originally published by Duncan Riley Publishing, 2023. Book synopsis. Bill Roundtree writes about his contact with aliens over a 50-year period. He takes us on a journey that is both incredible and personal. The book also gives us some scientific statistics on alien abduction. Preface. I was born in the late 1950s in Atlanta, Georgia, and grew up in a very traditional suburban lifestyle. But I had some very unusual experiences, beginning at about age 8, that have continued for over 50 years. I initially told my family about the experiences, but I was ridiculed, so I learned to keep quiet. Then in my teenage years, I came to learn that it was intelligent life from another planet that was visiting me, so I was even more motivated to talk to someone about my experiences. I told my friends about a very small part of the story to gauge their reactions, but as expected, they also ridiculed me, so I continued to keep it all a secret as the years went on and the visits continued. I graduated from college with a degree in Management Information Systems, and I went on to have a successful career, eventually managing over 100 multi-million dollar computer software projects for Fortune 500 companies. I also had a great family, a very successful son, and great friends, everything I could want. But in the meantime, my enigmatic experiences continued, and I never told anyone else about them until now. I've read that some people who make claims of having encounters with aliens are not considered credible sources because they might have ulterior motives, such as money or fame, and therefore their claims are not considered valid. But I want to make it clear that I do not need to write this book for any possible financial gain, as I retired early with multiple houses, cars, and boats, so I am financially secure, and I am certainly not after any notoriety. Actually, it's just the opposite. I know that by writing this book, I will just open myself back up to ridicule and possible harassment. But after over 50 years of silence, it's time for me to share my experiences in depth. My story needs to be heard, and I don't want to keep it a secret any longer. The first section of this book is titled What I Know, because it details my experiences in which I was visited by a device averaging 2 or 3 times a year that I knew from the start was clearly not from this world. Usually it just observed me until I did something to make it leave. But then a voice spoke to me on 2 occasions, revealing that they were intelligent life forms from another planet, as well as telling me some other clues as to why they are here. The second section is titled What I Believe, because I tell of other experiences that I've had that are not cold, hard facts like the visits I received, but instead are more open to interpretation. I also write about a few alien experiences from other very credible sources, and I share some fascinating scientific information on the possible existence of other intelligent life in the universe, as well as other information about near-death experiences, NDE, from the new documentary film After Death, and the International Association for Near-Death Studies. I conclude with several chapters on what I believe it all means, including how it all relates to the afterlife, reincarnation, and our guardian angels. As you read my book, I believe you will agree that it is different than other books about alien encounters, because I have been visited by aliens over 100 times, spanning more than 50 years, so I have no doubt that my experiences are genuine. Aliens visiting Earth are not ready to have their presence here known, so no one has all of the answers as to who they are and what they are doing here. But after over 50 years of experiences, I definitely have some answers to those questions. I believe if you keep an open mind as you read and consider my experiences, along with those of other credible sources and the additional data I present, you will understand how I arrived at my conclusions and may begin to agree with many of them. This is the end of today's excerpt.
Well, that's our podcast for this week. And if you could do me a big favor, I would really appreciate it if you left a positive review on the Apple Podcast platform, because that bumps our show up in the ratings. So if you can do that, that would be fantastic. And until next time, this is Michael Ryan. Keep watching the skies.
You have been listening to the UFO Talker. If you have any questions or comments on this episode, You can email us at ufotalker@bell.net or visit our website at ufotalker.ca. You can support UFO Talker by using the Buy Me a Coffee app with links on our website and in the show notes. We appreciate every listener. Thank you for your support. This has been a Michael Ryan production.
30, that's a wrap.